Thursday, March the 8th. Committee members, we have a long agenda today, and it's likely to be disrupted by the other events that are going on in the building. Let me just roadmap this a little bit for you. We're going to start with a public hearing on House Bill 2857 on court facilities. Then we will go to a public hearing on House Bill 2764, and then go on to a public hearing on House Bill 2768. The work sessions that are put on the agenda will likely be over toward the end of the agenda. My expectation is that the public hearings on Senate Bills 189 and 260 will follow on at the end of the agenda and likely be rolled over until tomorrow rather than held today. So with that, I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2857, and I'd like to invite Representative Krieger to make some introductory remarks here. Actually, after Council Taylor will first introduce the bill, but then we'll hear from Representative
Chairman Krieger. Of the Committee, House Bill 2857 comes here at the request of the State Court Facilities Task Force, and among other things, it creates a court facilities account in the general fund, provides money in the account for the purposes of paying the cost of maintaining, improving, replacing, or expanding state court facilities.
Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Wayne Krieger, State Representative, District 1 from the South Coast. I'm going to talk just very briefly, but I wanted to refer back to the Public Commission on the Oregon Legislature, and the commission looked carefully at the legislative needs for adequate facilities and found that the wings that we happen to spend a lot of time in were totally inadequate in the systems. The computer networks were overloaded, and circulation of air was bad. A whole thing of fire hazard, seismic things need to be fixed. We knew that back in 2001 when it was looked at, and the anticipated cost at that time were somewhere in the neighborhood, I believe, $17 to $18 million. Now when we look at it, because we hesitated, and hesitation was due partly because of the recession we experienced, and I understand that, but because we were not able to act, that same repair today is about $35 million. As to the court facility needs, most of the courthouses, including many of those that are in my district, need repair and more than the capital wing do. The court operations are affected by the inadequate facilities that house them, and the public has a right to a certain level of safety and comfort when using these important centers of community. The wings were, I believe, 30 or 35 years old. Our courts are somewhere on the average of 50 to 100, with a couple of them older than that. And although the courthouses are now the responsibilities of the counties, we must, as a legislature, face this problem at a state level, since the fiscal problems that the counties face are not only going to be getting worse. And of course, that you take a look at the timber revenues and the counties that are going to be losing that, losing the sheriff's offices. And so we've got some huge things. They are not going to be able to even maintain those facilities, let alone bring them up to the standards and replace them. Senator Burdick and I did participate in the work group that is proposing this bill and the companion bill in the Senate to deal with this problem. And I feel that these bills really are part of the discussion. And I, you know, having seen this bill come out and being contacted in my office, there's a great deal of resistance to some of the proposals in these bills, and I understand that. But if nothing else, I think we've got to the point where we're making people aware that this is a problem and that we need to address it, and putting it off is not going to be acceptable.
Very good. Any questions for Representative Krieger? Thank you very much.
Chair.
Oh, Representative Kopp.
Representative Krieger, just a moment. Thank you, Chair McPherson. Representative Krieger, have you done any, is there any data or statistical information about how old courthouses are, how much how many, I mean, are there seismic needs, American disability adjustments? I mean, any kind of a fiscal, what kind of costs we're talking about overall?
I don't have that with me. I do believe it was some of that information was gathered for the work group. They may be here today to present that.
Okay.
I don't know that.
Thank you. Okay,
thank you. Thank you, Representative
Krieger. I'd like now to invite forward a panel of Chief Justice Paul DeMunis, Steve Janik, and Paul Snyder. Chief Justice DeMunis.
Good morning, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. I'm Paul DeMunis, Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court. I want to thank you for the opportunity to offer some brief remarks for the committee. Mine will be general in nature, and I'd like to begin first by thanking Representative Krieger. I'm not sure that I could, I don't think I could expand on his remarks. Thank you very much, Representative Krieger. Our constitutional democracy is founded in part on the principle that the judiciary is a co-equal and independent branch of government. Yet, in many important ways, the Oregon judiciary is also an interdependent branch of state government. The problems that we face in Oregon today do not fit neatly within the lines where one branch of government ends and another begins. These complex issues demand interdisciplinary solutions. The problem that this bill addresses is one of those complex issues that require the cooperation and innovation of all three branches of government. The building we are in, our state capitol, is the symbol of the executive and legislative branches of state government. For the judicial branch, however, the symbols are not confined to a single building in Salem. Instead, the judicial branch of Oregon is symbolized in every county by a county courthouse that stands as a continuous assurance that justice is available to everyone throughout the state. Courthouses that are not accessible to the mobility impaired do not stand for the proposition or do not demonstrate that justice is available to everyone everywhere in this state. Unfortunately, Oregon has a court facility problem, and after decades of postponing action, the problem has reached crisis proportion in many counties. The crisis calls out for a statewide, systematic solution to keep the justice system functioning and in several counties, even to protect lives and avoid catastrophe. The deteriorating condition of many of our courthouses threatens the ability of courts to function. Working together, three branches of government, we must develop a long-term statewide court facilities funding system to solve the inadequacies that exist and to meet those that will arise. This will ensure that safe and secure court facilities will continue to stand for the availability of justice for everyone, everywhere in this state. Such a system will need to embrace the unique circumstances of each county and will need to be developed collaboratively by the legislature, the courts, the counties, and the bar. To begin to deal with the problems of the state courthouses, a task force, as Representative Krieger indicated, composed of members of the judicial branch, representatives of the Association of Oregon Counties, and the Oregon State Bar has been assessing data about the condition of our county courthouses throughout the past year. The task force was chaired by Jerry Gatos of the Oregon State Bar, Bobby Green, County Commissioner for Lane County, and myself. It was comprised of equal members of three organizations, as well as ex officio members of the legislature, the governor's office, and the Oregon Sheriff's Association. In that regard, I want to acknowledge the commitment to intergovernmental cooperation displayed by Senator Burdick and Representative Krieger. Their participation in the task force and their guidance and wisdom on this state's infrastructure issue is exactly the kind of interbranch cooperation that is necessary to address many of the difficult problems we confront in this state. The purpose of the task force was to study and make recommendations on these things. What changes are needed in the size of facilities and the utilization of facilities in the coming years? Whether the state should be responsible for the cost of these changes, and what are the ownership options for these these facilities? How much will these changes cost, and how to finance these changes? The beginning of a solution to this problem is embodied in the two bills, Senate Bill 733, which establishes a court facilities commission to develop guidelines for suitable and sufficient, how to prioritize the projects, and to conduct a study to determine the exact need for improvements and replacements statewide. This House bill establishes a dedicated revenue source to begin to facilitate the financing of the needed repairs, expansion, and replacement. I want to just briefly put this in context for you. In Representative Krieger's district, the Coos County Courthouse can only house three of four of its judges. The fourth judge is in North Bend, and the facility there can only handle certain kinds of cases. The operational areas of the court have been pushed into inadequate space. There's no space for the records needed to run the court. The water pipes are in poor condition. All water fountains have been removed. The electrical system requires clerks to be careful of what pieces of equipment are in use at the same time so that fuses do not blow out in the middle of a case. The heating system fails at least two times each winter. In Grant County, just a few weeks ago, the boiler went out for the better part of a week. The courtroom was in the low 50s, and staff offices were being heated by portable heaters. When I was in Grant County last year, I came just on the heels of a case in which the victim of the crime that was in trial was a paraplegic, and they had no elevator, and they could not get her to the second floor courthouse. They had to recess that trial and move to another state office and able to conduct that. These kind of things happen regularly there. In the Union County Courthouse in LeGrand, the courthouse was condemned and the operations were moved into an old hospital facility. That occurred in 1991. That was supposed to be temporary. In the facility where they are today, there's only one toilet. Staff was walked through the courthouse to reach the accounting department, and the public has no access to records or the accounting department without going outside. Concrete pillars are spaced in the courtroom where it restricts the view of judges, the litigants, and the jury. In fact, when the judges conduct voir dire in that courtroom, they don't ask the jurors whether they're citizens. They ask them if they were born in that particular room. The Multnomah County Courthouse was built in 1914. It was designed to house less than half the judges that have courtrooms in it today. It has significant fire and safety issues, mechanical and electrical problems. Raw sewage has flowed through that courthouse. Water pipes break with great regularity. The most worrisome issue is the near certain collapse of the building if a significant earthquake were to occur. 3,500 to 5,000 Oregonians enter that courthouse every day. The Clackamas County Courthouse is 70 years old and worn out. Originally built to accommodate county government and one circuit judge, it has been reconfigured to accommodate 10 judges. Over time, courtrooms have been carved out of space previously used for other functions, resulting in crowding essential court functions into inadequate space. That county has needed a new courthouse for at least 35 years. In Enterprise, the courtroom and the clerk's office in Wallowa County Courthouse are on the second floor. There is no elevator. The regular courtroom is therefore inaccessible to the mobility impaired. The examples I've provided you are the most extreme needs. However, the problems they face are very typical. Seismic risk, inadequate space, inadequate basic amenities like heat, electricity, plumbing are problems the majority of court facilities face across Oregon. And while the Wallowa County Courthouse is an egregious case, many others pose physical access problems for people with disabilities. Why do we need to act now? I think Representative Krieger made the case. Currently, interest rates are low, rising construction costs. A healthy court system is crucial to economic development and to the maintenance of healthy communities. We can no longer put off dealing with the condition of Oregon's courthouse. This issue has been discussed over the last 20 years without resolution. We can no longer wait. This is a problem that requires an inter-branch solution. The judicial branch looks forward to working with your branch and the executive branch to make sure that our courts are safe and continue to stand for justice for everyone everywhere in this state. Thank you again for the opportunity to discuss these issues with you today.
Are there any questions for Justice Domínguez? Thank you, Justice. Mr. Janik.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you this morning. For the record, I'm Steve Janik of the Ball Janik Law Firm. I'm here today representing the Oregon State Bar, appointed by the State Bar to be on the task force. I am a business lawyer, and that's the perspective I bring to this issue. I would note that Commissioner Dennis Lutz of Deschutes County would join in this testimony were he here today, but unfortunately he is not able to be here based on county business. Over the last year, I served as a member of the Court Facilities Task Force, and I'm here today for two purposes. First, I want to convey the support of the Oregon State Bar for this bill that's before you and for its companion legislation, Senate Bill 733. The Bar is fully supportive of the efforts of the task force and urges you to pass this legislation. Second, I want to explain to you how the task force developed the financing mechanism that is reflected in this legislation. I served on the finance subcommittee of the task force, and our task was to look at the various alternatives for creating a sustainable revenue stream from sources that were connected with the functions of the courts. We also developed estimates of the cost statewide of these facility improvements, renovations, and replacements. Today, the problem is there is simply not a stable, predictable, long-term funding source to solve this long-term problem. The counties don't have the money. Without a stable, predictable funding source, bonds cannot be sold. Without a stable funding source, the problem will come back to one place, the general fund, and it'll come back at the time of a crisis, any one of which are readily discernible from the Chief Justice's comments. The bill before you does several things. First, it authorizes lottery proceeds to be used for financing construction and renovation. It authorizes the use of certificates of participation for the same purposes. It authorizes courts to be the recipients of seismic rehabilitation grants, which are among the biggest risk factors, as the Chief Justice noted. It creates the state court facilities account that can only be used for the cost of maintaining, improving, replacing, or expanding state court facilities. And it establishes two stable, predictable funding sources to fill that account with sufficient funds to make this work. A $3 per document increase in the document recording fees where documents are recorded in the counties, and a two-step increase in the annual filing fees for corporations, limited liability companies, and other entities that benefit from the state-granted limit liability protection. That would be a $50 increase on January 1, 2008, and an additional $50 increase on January 1, 2009. What these sources do is they create a funding revenue stream against which bonds can be sold, and to create a fund out of which we can take care of the needs of the courts. I would note that the bill in front of you doesn't exactly capture our task force recommendation on the document filing fee. We wanted it at $3 per page, not $3 per document. And I think there's an error in the text of the bill. The preamble to the bill makes it clear that we are seeking $3 per page. And if you note, $3 per page has a good impact, which is the smaller transactions pay less, the larger transactions with larger number of pages pay more. The revenue generated from these increases will total $24 million in 2007-09 biennium. $9 million comes from the $3 increase in the per document recording fee. It would be $18 million, which is what we are seeking at the $3 per page fee. $15 million will come from the two-step increase in the annual filing fees of corporations and limited liability companies during the 08-09 biennium. In the 09-11 biennium, revenues from these two sources would total $44 million. And in the 2007-2009 biennium, funds generated by these sources would be used only for paying the costs of studying and preparing the recommendations relating to precisely what we need to do to make sure that every courthouse in this state is appropriate for the judicial function. Now, in future years, once we've sold the bonds, then these revenue streams would be able to pay off the bonds. Now, the estimated total cost we're looking at, as the Chief Justice explained to you, statewide, most courthouses need significant renovations in order to function properly, and quite frankly, many need to be replaced outright. The cost of doing this is estimated to be between $225 million for the least cost solution to over $500 million, which includes the necessary replacements. The committee found these estimates by looking at other courthouses that have actually been constructed, and needless to say, many of those were not in this state, and looking at the per square foot cost using the assistance of architects who generated this data for us. So it's a real-world cost that we then took and said, okay, how many square feet of courthouses in this state need to be refurbished or replaced? It's not a precise estimate, but it's a close ballpark for these purposes. But in the next biennium, we want to study that and become precise. Now, there are two reasons why we are recommending that we immediately grapple this problem and sell the bonds now. We have a unique historic opportunity. The interest rates to be paid on the bonds sold would be at historic all-time lows for at least the last four decades. Those would be fixed rates of interest. So our revenue streams could support a much larger amount of bonds at a lesser cost. At the same time, however, in the last 3 years, we've seen extraordinary increases in construction costs. So if we wait longer to solve the problem, we're only going to see construction costs likely to increase even more. What we found is that if we wait and don't do anything soon and take advantage of these opportunities, our costs in terms of total debt service over time would virtually double or triple. Now, we understand that some members of this committee have reservations about the annual filing fee increases on corporations and limited liability companies, both because of the fact that there may be the need for a three-fifths majority to approve those, and also because there is considerable attention in this session being given to corporate taxation. We're not wedded to the precise mix of revenue streams we've proposed to you, but we offer them to you as what is, in our judgment, the best two sources for you to carefully examine and to balance. We also know that some might tell you that the $3 per page or $3 per document increase in the recording fee is somehow going to depress the number of transactions. As a lawyer who's practiced real estate law for 33 years, I doubt that. I doubt that very seriously. Transactions are not driven by the presence or absence of a $3 per page filing fee. We are aware of one amendment that is needed to the bill in front of you. Currently, there is a court facilities account that exists under ORS 1.190 and 1.192 that needs to be repealed. We don't want confusion between these two accounts, and that serves an entirely different function. And we also feel that it's necessary to add an emergency clause to this amendment. So again, I thank you very much for the opportunity to address you. This is an issue of great concern to the bar, and we appreciate your time and consideration. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Janik. Are there any questions? Representative Cameron.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Mr. Janik, you headed up the, you were part of the Finance Subcommittee, is that what you said?
Yes, that's correct.
And you're a business attorney. Was there any businesses that were represented on that committee to talk about these fees and how they felt and what they wanted to participate in this?
There was a representative appointed by the Oregon State Bar, Paul Hurd, who's the general counsel of Freightliner.
But any business owners that were not attorneys?
I don't believe there were.
Thank you.
Mr. Janik, in your experience in your law practice, what would the impact of the fee on limited liability entities, that is corporations and LLCs, be on the formation of those entities at adding an extra $50 or $100 a year?
When people choose a form to do business, they have to confront the issue of whether they want personal liability or they want limited liability. the state allows, and it's a privilege the state grants, that one can elect to have limited liability. And to do so, you file a form, and you pay an annual filing fee. I think the compelling business reasons for having limited liability are so powerful that an additional $50 or an additional $100 will not make a material difference.
Mr. Chair, if I may follow up, I just left a another meeting that we're discussing $200 increases on S corporations, which would follow underneath this as another minimum. So we're talking, and when you're looking at this, you're looking at $300. And I do think that it's easy to say those kinds of things, but to not have small businesses represented when we're looking at a $100 fee or somebody who might have several small businesses, and a limited liability company, I think it's important to know that you can have a limited liability company for something that has actually no activity in it and generates no revenue for that particular year. So I just think that we need to be very careful when we're looking at these small, we say small fees, and there's fees coming throughout this whole building.
Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Chair, and I don't have any person that anybody can answer this. A couple of questions are surrounding the law. The biggest question in my mind is, why haven't things been done in the past? And I come from a school background. In the mid-'80s, we started looking at our ADA requirements. We took out asbestos in our schools, and that came at a cost to less staff, less textbooks in our classrooms, multiple ways of meeting those federal mandates. I have served in a school. We had raw sewage in our bathroom. We had classrooms without heat for weeks at a time because of a 50-year-old boiler system. So I empathize with what you're saying. But my biggest question is, when we started looking at school budgets, and there's currently been a work group for a full year now about capital construction and how we possibly can help our communities with an overall much bigger solution rather than adding fees, because I think we already did that when we put the pop machines in our schools. But did you guys get that? Another bill. I know that there's many people out there that have not paid their delinquent judgments, and that's a huge amount of money. I would be interested to see what solutions are there at trying to recoup those funds rather than assessing another fee. But I've asked a whole bunch of things, but any thoughts on any of it?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd like to answer that if you may. I'm Paul Snyder from the Association of Oregon Counties. Mr. Chair, Representative Comp, with respect to the facilities that the counties operate and own, it goes back to 1981 when the court takeover actually occurred.
Mm-hmm.
Up until that point, basically everybody who worked for a circuit court at that time was a county employee. In 1981, the court system was consolidated, and the cost of operating the courts was transferred to the state. The cost of providing the facilities remained with the counties for a number of reasons. One of them was it was very difficult to figure out how you unravel the fact that those facilities are occupied by county folks, by state folks, different people on different floors, and who would have responsibility if we were to change that was a mystery at the time, and in some respects still is. But it was figured that the cost of operating the courts was an appropriate trade-off for the counties to continue to accept responsibility for the facilities. Since 1981, a number of things have changed. One of them was passage of Measure 5. Another was passage of Measure 50. These ballot measures substantially changed the ability of local governments to derive revenues from historical sources. Another thing that's been an issue for us over time recently has been the loss, I'm sure everybody knows about this, of the Federal Forest Safety Net funding. In fact, Mr. Janik alluded to the fact that Commissioner Luke would be here, but for the fact that he's needed for a quorum. The reason why he's needed for a quorum is the other commissioner is in Washington, D.C., lobbying for restoration of the safety net. Commissioner Nada would be here, but for the fact that she's in Washington, D.C., lobbying for the safety net. But with respect to those losses, a number of counties which have historically relied upon funding sources that relate to the existence of the forests and the fact that most of the state of Oregon is owned by the federal government have been placed in a position recently where they don't have available useful alternatives for raising money. And those issues in particular have been problematic in those counties, and they threaten to be substantially worse in the next several months.
Just a comment, follow up. Again, I empathize, but the scenario you're stating is one that is prevalent in almost every entity of government in this state because of the exact reasons of ballot measures that have limited our opportunities to do any proactive or long-term planning in any of these areas. And regretfully, we're in a catch-up mode. Our buildings are crumbling around us. And, yeah, I don't have a solution either.
Representative Cameron.
Yeah, I want to maybe backtrack a little bit on my previous comments and talk about the overall picture here. And I understand that this is a tragedy that's come upon our state. Public safety is a number one priority of myself, and I understand the court systems are important in that. Yesterday I toured the state through three of the penitentiary things and saw their need for construction, and it's coming out of the general fund. And I just want to be supportive and encourage us to put our priorities right in this building. And if we're talking about state police or courts or other things that we need to do to supply the citizens of this state the security that they need to thrive and to be good families, we need to put our priorities in the right place. And to go out and say we don't have the money with a 20% increase to help our court system, I just think is a wrong way to go. And I want to just apologize for being a little angst on this these fees, but we continue to hear all these fees, and yet as a group in this building we don't put our priorities straight. And that's what I just wanted to say about supportive of courts. It's important for our public safety system. Thank you.
Mr. Snyder, did you have prepared remarks in addition to the question and response that you gave?
Just briefly, Mr. Chair, if I may. Again, for the record, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties and appearing in support of House Bill 2857. We support the entire legislation. There is one piece, though, with respect to the document recording fee upon which we have not taken a position yet, and that may change this following Monday. But with respect to the rest of the bill and with respect to our participation in the task force, I can tell you that all our members who participate in the task force unanimously recommended approval of all the provisions of this, as well as Senate Bill 733. Mr. Chair and members, I think my response to Representative Kahn's question covers most of the remarks that I wanted to cover otherwise, and so I'll just discontinue comments and stand for questions.
Are there any more questions for any member of this panel?
Maybe not a question, Mr. Chair, but you know, the Chief Justice has really reached out to the legislative branch, not just on this, but on several other issues, which I won't go into today, where we are communicating. I'm even going to try to get him to come out and have dinner with me, maybe. Have a beer at the Outback and a steak. But I really appreciate that that's there. And the fact that he is bringing us together and he's had the strength to come forward with something that's been on the back burner for 30, 40 years. And you heard his comments to us today. And I don't know of a person in the state of Oregon that has the integrity to the standard that I hold him in. And boy, when I say that, I know a lot of people, and I'm pretty critical sometimes of people's conduct, but if this man's talking to us, we better be listening, because what he's telling you is fact. And as a result of that, if this isn't the right process, and I'm not saying it isn't, we really need to find a way very, very quickly to address this, because as he says, it's been there, it's going to get a lot worse. And I think we've got the right people in the process within that work group, the committee that he had, to start us down that path, but we need to be on with it in some way.
Thank you, Representative Krieger, and I want to second your remarks about the leadership that the Chief Justice has brought on this and other issues to us in this process. Representative Kahn?
Well, and thank you. I totally concur, because I don't want to be perceived as putting up barriers for solutions, but we just, again, with what Representative Cameron is saying, is that, we need to be open to all options here to take care of this situation.
Very good. Okay, gentlemen, thank you very much for coming in today. Just an update on proceedings. We understand the House is in recess until 9:45, so we're going to proceed ahead through this hearing and then on in the order I described earlier. We have a couple of witnesses signed up in opposition to the bill, Jim Marquis and James Morales, and in the interest of time, I'll invite both of you up at the same time.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Marquis, today representing the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association and the Oregon Collectors Association. I first want to say that I'm certainly not going to argue that we don't have a problem with our courthouses. We do, and we need to do something about it. And I would commit on behalf of my client to work with the legislature and with the judicial branch on that problem from this day forward. I think it's somewhat unfortunate, and I appreciated Representative Cameron's remarks about who was on the task force to look at this issue during this last interim. And I think the business community was simply absent from that task force, and I think they weren't really invited, at least my clients weren't invited in to be part of that process and part of the solution. I think the business community has shown in the past that they are willing to step up and solve problems on behalf of the Judicial Department in terms of legal aid funding, in terms of shortages and operation money. We've stepped up with surcharges on filing fees, and we've stepped up with legal aid fees and all kinds of programs when we've been asked to, and I would encourage the judicial branch to include the business community in future endeavors in this area. We are very concerned about the funding mechanisms created in this particular bill, House Bill 2857. The surcharges on recording fees with the county clerk have become the tax du jour in this building. And it costs $5 per page to record a document with the county. And there was a comment made earlier, would a surcharge, would these recordings be depressed? Well, probably not, because most of those documents are required to be recorded. You have to record them. So $5 a page for the recording fee seems like a bargain, but then add a $10 surcharge for the county's assessment program for their lands, add a $1 surcharge for a statewide mapping program that the legislature approved, add another $10 surcharge for the land corner preservation program, which is for the county surveyors to help them preserve land corners. So that's $21. Then add this $3, and then and apparently this is going to be $3 a page, not just $3 on each document as the other surcharges are. And then we have a bill proposed which has broad support in this building to add a $15 surcharge for affordable housing projects. And I'm telling you that at some point this gets too expensive. And the poor county clerks, I talked to the county clerks who said they're the ones that have to explain this to citizens when they come in about why it costs so much to file this little piece of paper with them. So I'm just telling you that I don't think this is the way to do it. I would tell you that it's interesting to me, this bill repeals the present law, as does 20... There is a court facilities account in Chapter 1 of the ORS today. This bill would repeal it and replace it with a different court facilities fund. Representative Comp mentioned uncollected judgments, and I would say the judicial branch does have currently about $540 million in uncollected criminal judgments. Criminal judgments being broadly defined to include everything except parking tickets. So $200 to $300 million of that is in traffic tickets that we haven't collected. I'm sort of interested that we spend so much money and we're so interested in getting state police out on the road to write these tickets, but we never seem to collect the money after we write the ticket. There is not one dime of interest being charged on any of those judgments. And judicial branch says they have a problem with their computer system. They can't compute the interest. I'll accept them at their word that that's somehow difficult to compute 9% interest on all of these judgments. But if we were charging interest and actually doing a better job collecting those, it is a perfect source of revenue and a complete nexus to help with these court facility problems. And I just think that we ought to be looking, I think, at the court system itself and how can we use the court system itself to fund these projects in a better way. With that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Are there questions, Mr. Marquis? Mr. Marquis, I got a little lost in the summary of the cost. For a three-page document, what does it currently cost to record a three-page document in one of our counties?
Well, let me. Currently, it costs $5 a page, so that'd be $15. And then there are $21 in surcharges on top of that.
So count.
$36.
My grade school math says $36.
$36 today. Okay. Now, you know, but then we have a $3 fee here and a $15 fee being proposed. This would be $3 apparently per page, so that would add $9. So add another $24. And frankly, you know, mortgage documents, 3-4 pages, 5 pages, up to 30 pages on a commercial deal, and sometimes 3 or 4 documents that have to be recorded. And we're trying to help people with affordable housing, and we're creating all of this front end cost at the front of buying a house.
If there are no questions for Mr. Marquis, then Mr. Morales.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, representatives of the committee. James Morales, representing the Oregon Association of County Clerks. I've submitted written testimony. I just want to, first of all, commend the legislators for having always recognized in the past when a fee is implemented, making sure that fee is related at the point of collection to the service that fee shall be providing as well. That has always been the case for the recording fees mentioned here today. And we'd like to see that practice continued, and we know that the legislators in the past have always done that. And that is part of my testimony here today, recognizing that these fees that have always been collected on real property and deed, mortgage, and lien records have always related to the functions that thrive on these real property records that feed off them, like the assessment and taxation fee, the land corner preservation fee, which our surveyors utilize, and as well as the OLIS, the land information system. In Benton County, we also have a GIS fee, which is a geographic information systems fee that that we impose. So a one-page document is $41 at Benton County currently, which is where I serve as a clerk. But I'm here on behalf of the Association of County Clerks. And part of what this bill does is it also strips the ability of the counties to collect administrative costs for this fee that would be the bulk of what you're looking at here today. I think I heard the figure of close to $44 million over a biennium that they're looking to generate in revenue. And the way the bill is written, that would be collected free of cost by the county clerks and transmitted to the state. Well, it takes a lot of tracking and work to take care of $40 million. And the current statutes have within them the ability for clerks to collect the administrative costs to the counties for collecting and administering these fees. Well, this particular bill bypasses the language that would allow us to do so, and so we pointed that out. The bill also does contain some flawed language in the summary versus the actual bill itself. The summary identifies a $3 per page fee on county clerk lien records, which is only a portion of our records. That is not what the bill is doing. The county clerk lien record is one of the records that we maintain, but there's also the deed and the mortgage records, which in the language of the bill, this fee would apply to deed, mortgage, and lien records. It's not per page as written, it's per document as written. And the amount of revenue at which they would be looking to generate would not be met in this manner. However, the clerks feel that to make sense of this whole fee issue, we would propose an amendment to the bill to allow the state courts to collect a filing fee on state court filings and hearing fees to be able to support state court facilities. It just makes too much sense. It's the manner in which legislators in the past have always operated. And so we're proposing a similar type of amendment to this bill to allow this to go forward to the Oregon citizens. When they pay a fee, citizens of Oregon like to know that that fee is related to the service that they're receiving. Real property records, the clerks don't see the relation between the real property records and the state court facilities. State court collect the fee, we do see the relationship where the state courts collect a fee to support state courts. And so I've also provided to you today a proposed amendment, not set in stone, but just getting, as we were talking about earlier, getting the ball started on trying to find real solutions. We recognize the facilities as a real problem that counties and states are having to deal with, and we were also not a part of this task force, but we would like to try and bring forth solutions as well, because we do see it as an issue that needs to be dealt with. And I'm open to any questions.
Mr. Morales, can you tell us what proportion of the county clerks, the recording office that people go to record a document when they hand it in, of the 36 counties, how many of those are conducted inside the courthouse itself? I think in some cases it may be off in a separate facility.
Right. Well, we did do some research on this, and about two-thirds of the clerk's office where the recordings are done are located in the same building. However, two-thirds of the revenue that would be generated would be coming from clerks' recorders' offices that are outside, so that the majority of the revenue that's looking to be generated would come from clerks that are outside of the state court facilities.
Any further questions for Mr. Morales? Council Taylor.
Mr. Morales, you kept referring it to a state court facilities, but my understanding is it's the counties that own and operate the building since the, as Mr. Snyder mentioned, the agreement that was reached in 1981. I mean, when I walk into Marion County Courthouse, it's Marion County, not, isn't that correct?
That's correct, and the way the bill is written is that the funds that are generated by these clerk, county clerk collected fees could only be spent on the state court portion of the facility. The bill is very restrictive on in that regard. It doesn't say anything about being able to spend it on the county clerk's facilities in the same building as the state courts. It says no, to expand and improve and maintain the state court facilities.
But, Mr. Chair, if I could follow up, but isn't that currently a county obligation?
Perhaps, you know, the decision made in 1981 was not the most long-term thought-out solution as for growth and current situations. But, yes, the counties are currently obligated to provide the facilities to the state courts.
Thank you. Any further questions for Mr. Morales?
Just comment, Chair, because what council brings up is the predicament that was identified at the beginning of testimony. You know, we have the state and county consortium. How do you call it? Like that word. And so it has become, you know, I mean, to me it's like who's responsible. So it is confusing.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cameron.
Just some, thank you, Mr. Chair, just some point of clarification maybe from council. So even though it says a state court's fund, what we're basically saying is that that money could be used by Marion County for their courthouse because they have an obligation to the state to provide that courthouse. Is that, I want to make
Mr.
sure
Chairman
we're clear
of the committee,
on this.
That is my understanding of the law. That's my understanding, particularly going back to 1981. And I believe that's why you see a county-state work group. This issue has been before the legislature as long as I can remember.
Yeah. So there is, just to clarify, there is not a problem with this being, as maybe our witness just said, that this could only be used in state court facilities. It could be used in what we would perceive as county court facilities as well.
Right. I mean, hear me recite for the benefit of the committee my understanding, which is the operation of our courts is a state function. The facilities in which they operate has, for the last 25 years, the understanding has been that's a county function, and the counties have had great difficulty dealing with the facilities issues that they've faced, and with the distress that some of our counties are in, it looks like that situation will continue if it remains purely a county obligation to deal with facilities issues. So with this, the proposal here is to provide a funding source that's statewide to assist counties in dealing with court facilities projects.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, then I'll excuse this panel. And we have just one more witness signed up on this, Harlan Levy. And I didn't get an indication of whether for or against, but so Mr. Levy, if you're, you could come forward and tell us your position on this.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. For the record, I am Harlan Levy, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. I do want to say that I am a member of the Oregon State Bar. I hope that will continue after I deliver this testimony. We share some of the concerns about this bill that you just heard from the previous two witnesses. We're very concerned about the $3 per page document recording fee. We don't see the nexus there between real estate transactions, which are what would be generating the fee, and then facilities, court facilities. You've heard some talk about some other proposals that are currently in the building with respect to other document recording fees. And there are there is a nexus there between affordable housing and that other fee. So we don't necessarily oppose all document recording fees. However, in this case, we just don't see the connection. And it would have a significant impact. $3 per page on some more complicated transactions could generate a pretty large fee. I do have a couple of suggestions, though, for this committee to consider. We think that it would be a much more equitable and there would be a much more direct nexus for such a fee to be applied to court filings. And you just heard that from one of the previous witnesses. When plaintiffs file their complaint, when defendants file their answer, and so on and so forth, there is a much more direct nexus there. Again, at the risk of putting my bar ticket at stake, perhaps even a surcharge on bar dues, there's a much more direct nexus there as well. With that, I will quit while I'm ahead.
It's too late.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cameron.
Yeah, I have already figured that out. There's 12,913 attorneys in the state of Oregon. It would only cost us $2,323 per attorney annually or biennium.
$2,323. Okay, got it.
Council Taylor. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I would hope that the Oregon State Legislature would continue to pay my bar dues in that case.
Be happy.
I'm sure, Council, you'd have to get a pay raise.
Yeah.
Do you want to dig yourself any deeper?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Krieger.
Just briefly, I think what really comes to light in my own mind is, having been here 6 years, counties, cities, and schools continue to struggle with capital construction dollars and maintenance dollars.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't find that in the free enterprise system to nearly this degree. They never let it get that bad. Part of their annual budget facilitates that being taken care of on a long-term basis. It's part of what even is required in a business plan. We're just not doing the job.
If there are no further questions, I'll excuse Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't necessarily have a question for Mr. Levy, although I admire his courage to say what he did in a room full of lawyers. I just wanted to pick up on the comment that Representative Krieger said about not planning ahead and doing the work. And looking back at the testimony, and I spent a lot of time in the Multnomah County Courthouse because I've taken groups of students in there as a court tour guide. And I tell you, it's a bit nerve-wracking at times knowing the condition of the building to have groups of students in there. I think what we really need to do is look at all the possibilities and find a way to address this, but we have to keep in mind that we're living in a state where our voters have passed some severe limitations on what we can do. And with regard to the comment that was made about the inabilities of counties with Measure 5 and Measure 47 and Measure 50 and an unstable tax structure, this is a situation that we're in part because of the decisions that have been made by voters in our state. And although, yes, I see it's difficult for the clerks to have to explain to people that they have to pay more money, maybe that's a good thing for them to know the consequences of this is the structure, the tax structure that we have and the system that the voters have created in some ways by those limitations. So I think we need to keep that in mind and look at all options. It's a serious problem, and I know it needs to be addressed. I would be interested in knowing, perhaps from some of the people who are still here, whether an increase in the court filing fee was considered as an alternative or in addition to the document recording fee. Thank you.
What I'm going to suggest, since we're really short on time here for and we have no further witnesses signed up, is that we need to take that into a work group process to look at the particular funding mechanisms that the task force brought forward. There are some other ideas. Find out why it is that those weren't pursued, and then see how a funding package could go forward. But as long as I've been serving now three sessions and these problems have not been attended to so far, it's time now that we try to figure out a solution to them.
Sure, just real quickly, the work group process would be great, but they're going to have to expedite their work. They need to start tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Today.
Today. We've got budgets. You know, the co-chairs are developing budgets, and we need to have something available to them so they understand, you know, what we're dealing with.
Okay. I certainly agree with that.
I will now close the public hearing on House Bill 2857 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2764. Council Taylor.
The committee, House Bill 2764, limits the number of medium and high-risk offenders that may be supervised by parole and probation officer who engage in case supervision. This has a prior referral to Ways and Means Committee. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Brian DeLashman.
Already ready. For the record, Brian DeLashman, representing the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers, as well as the Oregon Council of Police Associations. Both parole and probation officers and the police officers in the state have an interest in this particular bill, and you'll see the nexus as you hear the panel that's going to follow me. Given our limited time, I'll try and be extremely brief because I think the panel is going to be able to explain to you the situation far better than I will. The basic problem in this state is that we have underfunded community corrections, and that underfunding has manifested itself in the consequences that you will you'll hear about, which is caseloads in parole and probation officers, both of sex offenders, meth addicts, other high-risk offenders, are not being adequately supervised in our communities. Let me pause real briefly and say that's not the case in all communities, but in a number of communities. I don't think there is a disagreement on the fact that there is a problem out there and that the community correction system has been underfunded. I think there's an expectation by the people of the state of Oregon and also the legislature that people on parole and probation, in fact, are being adequately supervised, and you will hear some information that will lead you to believe the same way it's led me to believe that, in fact, that's not the case. You may, in fact, hear from some folks in opposition to this bill that it really is a matter of a difference between local control and state control. I would put this kind of similar to the situation about funding for schools. Does the state, in fact, have an obligation to look at caseloads because you're paying the bills? Well, in this case, we, in our infinite wisdom, pushed community corrections out to the local governments. We help fund those dollars, but is there an obligation by the state? Because this used to be a function of the state. You had a Department of Parole and Probation. All of these people were underneath your jurisdiction, but now they're out in the counties. You still have, because you are sending those resources out there, some obligation to make sure the system, in fact, is working correctly and that you're getting your best bang for the buck. With that, I'll end my testimony. I again, do not want to bring you this issue and say it is an issue in which the parole and probation officers that are actually doing the jobs aren't in an adversary position with their community corrections directors or their local jurisdictions. I think both of us are in this together. I think it's a matter that we need to look and make sure that we've got adequate funding and we're, in fact, doing the right mix, the right caseloads for these folks. And with that, I'll end my testimony and let you hear from the actual people that are doing the work.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Lashman. And the next the panel I have here is Randy Settle, Allison Nobinger, and Lucinda Carroll. Those are the people I have coming forward.
Good morning, Chair McPherson and members of the committee. My name is Randy Settle. I'm an adult parole and probation officer with Yamhill County Community Corrections. Been employed for eight-plus years, just a few weeks shy of 9 years, and I've actually been supervising both juvenile and adult sex offenders for 18 years. I have, over the years, grown to kind of fall into this business. If you would have asked me when I started college if I would have been a sex offender PO, I would have told you no. I could not even imagine going down that career path. Here I am 18 years later, supervising those individuals who commit very deviant and heinous crimes in our community. I come to you today to advise. We talk about caseload size. I supervise 85 convicted sex offenders today. My caseload has ranged anywhere from 75 to 100 convicted sex offenders at any given time. What does that mean to the community? That means 40 hours a week, or an average of 170 some hours a month. And you do the math and you say, well, how do I supervise 75 people effectively? I can make contacts. I can have them come to my office. I can see them. I can do the things that look good statistically. I can do those things that appear to look well. But the bottom line is, am I really providing the most adequate, responsible supervision to our community members? Am I making sure that the community is safe by having that size of a caseload? My position is no, I am not. When I oftentimes talk to community members, law enforcement, or other professionals, and they ask me what it is I do, how do I manage this caseload, my first response is I can't. It's a difficult task. Supervision becomes a reactive and not a proactive response. In other words, I have to wait to hear about the violation from the community, from local law enforcement. It's when they call me in the middle of the night, they say, you know, I have one of my offenders out having contact with minors, or they're out after their curfew, or they're doing something that is a violation of their supervision, whether it be parole or probation. I've given in my written testimony kind of a brief overview of what I do in an individual case. And part of that involves we review, sign conditions, I complete 3 to 4 different risk assessments on different offenders, depending on how they classify and what their risk is. We refer them to treatment, psychosexual evaluations, there's a referral packet, there's a number of different things, and I won't go through my whole entire list here. But just in one case, there's a lot of responsibilities that I have to that individual person. And again, you do the math times 75, you know there's not enough hours in the day to do everything adequately. I can do it. I can, like I said, I can make it look good, but it's not adequate. Part of the beginning process of supervision, we spend anywhere from 1.5 to 2 hours with each individual person. We review police reports, psych evals, polygraph reports. However, as supervision begins and we get into the 2 and 3 month period of time, those contacts actually diminish due to new clients that are coming through, either being released from prison or being released from jail. Those contacts, on an average, are 15 to 20 minutes in my office. And I even did the math, say, okay, if I got 75 people and I see them for 15 minutes, that's almost 19 hours. That's just the contact. That doesn't count any of the other things that I'm obligated to do statewide, writing reports, attending court hearings, staffings, trainings. That's just the contact in the office. That doesn't count any field work, doesn't count home visits, searches, reviewing computers, doing the things that are required as my job entails me to do. Some of my colleagues throughout the state, and to mention several counties, Columbia, Multnomah, Marion County, already have caps on their caseloads. And you said, well, why doesn't my individual county have that? As noted earlier by Brian, there's 36 counties, which really means there's 33 separate programs that are now, even though the state funds that, it goes back to each individual county to kind of establish those parameters, those guidelines, and really enforce that responsibility or even that philosophy on what each county will or will not do. My colleagues in these other counties, like I said, have established a cap. They believe it's important. Those caps average between 40 and 50 on their sex offender caseloads. Not 85, not 95 or 100, but it's 40 to 50. Multnomah County took a lawsuit before they made that decision. It was only when a sex offender raped and murdered a child, and then the county being sued, did they say it was important for us to reduce our caseload size and to manage these people appropriately, responsibly in the community. What are the benefits of having a smaller caseload? And I'm going to go ahead and read this one piece to make my testimony short. First of all, it frees up my time in the office. I'll spend more time in the offender's home. By being in their home, I will see the positive as well as the negative. I have been known to tell my colleagues, why can't I spend more time in the field? I really wish my vehicle was a personal office where I had a laptop computer, access to all the information I need, and I was out there 24/7. But that's not realistic. This is where we obtain collateral information about the offenders we supervise that we do not get in the office. appeal can spend more time with local law enforcement, working collaboratively to provide better supervision of the offender. When I'm in the home, I find the violations that I do not see from my office. I find the computer that the offender is not to have that later reveals he downloaded 35,000 images of child pornography. I find the drugs, the porn, offenders having contact with minors and victims. It's that place where I think it's important for the community. I look at community policing, and I've never been a police officer, but to understand community policing, and i.e. walking the beat, I look at the similarities between the two, and by putting myself out in the field, making those contacts, I'm visible, the offenders know that. When I do my work from the office and I'm not out there, they know they're not being supervised. At this time, the children of my community and your community are at risk due to these high caseloads. If I was a mother or father of a victim that had been sexually abused by an offender of my caseload, I'd want to know that that PO is checking on that offender in their home, not once a month or not once every 6 months or every 9 months that currently happens, because I can't get out there. And that's the reality. It's not what my director probably want me to tell you, but that's the reality. Unless I do a scheduled contact with that offender and say, you will be home on Thursday morning at 10 a.m., that's not a surprise visit. That's not a contact that allows me to really investigate and see what that person's doing. To give you one example, I made contact with one of my predatory sex offenders several years ago, knocked on his door early morning, 9 o'clock. He walked out the door, put his hands behind his back, and says, arrest me. I said, well, what for? He says, I've got a minor in my apartment. Okay. Cops went on, verified the minor was in there. He went to jail and went back to prison. The value of being out in the community is tenfold. I cannot emphasize the importance of that, and I can't do it with 85 people. And I think most of you, I would hope, could appreciate the danger that truly represents to the community. And as Brian stated, you know, early on, this isn't in opposition with our management. This is about community safety. And again, I'm not sure if this is the right bill before this committee. But doing the work that we do, trying to protect the community, this is a huge piece. We want to see these people succeed, but we also need to respond to public safety. And by doing that, we need to be out there. We need to see what they're doing. We need to know the different things they're doing. I ask for your support on House Bill 2764. I hope you see the value in it, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Mr. Sattel, for coming in, and thank you for the service that you do for Oregonians to keep them safe in their communities. It's a service that we all rely on and maybe too many of us take for granted, but it's good work that you and your colleagues do that really measurably improves our public safety. And I wanted to get those comments out in case we were pulled away to the floor under a call at any time. I wanted to make sure that you understand how important we regard the work you do. Ms. Novinger?
Yes, Allison Novinger. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm here as a member of the Federation of Parole and Probation Officers. I have been a parole officer in Washington County for over 20 years. I supervise a general property drug caseload. What I'd like to do today is kind of paint a picture of what that caseload may have looked like 10 years ago versus what it looks like today. The nature of the offender we supervise today is different than the nature of the offender we supervised 10 years ago. With the methamphetamine epidemic and the increase in ID theft and property theft as a result of that epidemic, crime rate and the effort to keep these people, these offenders, on the right track has become tenfold. 10 years ago, a caseload of 70 offenders, and what I'd like to do is paint an analogy of my workload in terms of a treadmill. 10 years ago, I'm on that treadmill at a good steady pace of maybe 4 or 5, getting the work done, supervising the offenders. Number of cases coming in is substantially less 10 years ago than the number of cases I received today. Right now, caseload of 70 medium and high-risk offenders. I was able to keep statistics of my caseload last year, and in 2006 alone, I received 114 new cases. I'm expected to keep my caseload at a size of around 70, and so in order to do that, I need to move those offenders through the system faster than I would like to, and they're not getting the services they need. The community's not getting the services they need in terms of supervising these offenders. In addition, with the handout that I handed out is the Intermediate Structured Sanctions Guideline that was implemented several years ago. There's the first two pages are a modified structured guidelines that Washington County has implemented as a means to respond to violations of offenders. These last three pages are the state's guidelines for intermediate structured sanctions. If you take a look at those intermediate structured sanctions, you have an offender who is a methamphetamine addict. You're facing a third violation for methamphetamine use. He's a high-risk offender, and you look at the structured sanctioning grid. He's a behavior level 2 for a third-time use of methamphetamine. He's a high-risk offender at the top of the scale. With this modified structured grid, I'm expected to impose 10 days jail for that offense. With the state grid, we're looking at 90 days. So these offenders are in and out of custody as a result of their violations at a much faster rate. And in 2006 alone, in keeping the statistics I did 316 warrant request violation reports or structured sanctions on the offenders I supervised. My treadmill is at 9 right now. I'm ready to fling off the back end and hit the back wall. I cannot keep up at the pace that we're going with the numbers that are coming in and off the caseload and adequately supervise these offenders in the community. In addition to looking at a caseload of 70 primary offenders, you have an outcount caseload of approximately 70 offenders. That outcount caseload is those people who have warrants, and so you close their case, you put them on a back burner, and you don't look at that as the number that you're actively supervising. That caseload in and of itself does not count towards the number of offenders you're getting, and that's a revolving caseload month to month. With my analogy, I need that treadmill to go back to a healthy pace so that I can effectively supervise the offenders, and I thank you for your time and listening to us today.
Lucinda Carroll.
Thank you. Good morning, representatives and chair. My name is Lucinda Carroll. I'm representing the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers as their legislative rep. I can tell you that POs feel strongly about the issue of manageable caseloads. It's our opinion that if community safety is important to you or your constituents, this bill needs to be looked at seriously. If you ask any POs with any experience what is the most effective way that they can supervise their offenders, they're going to respond it's caseload and caseloads that are manageable. If you ask them what it means, what is manageable, POs have always, with some experience, known that it's, well, somewhere between 50 and 60. When I reach 50 and 60, I know that I can do that active supervision. I know that I have the time to follow up on calls that we get from the community about possible bad behavior. Out there in the community, seeing them in their home, out there following up on anything, able to contact them when they start missing groups. Very important to keep them engaged in all aspects of their supervision. When caseloads get high, POs go to reactive mode, and the success rate of the offender goes way down. For example, I currently supervise the domestic violence caseload, and I was assigned to that team 3 years ago. When I first came on, that caseload was at 90. Over the last 3 years, I was slowly able to get it down into the 50s, and I cannot tell you what a difference that made in supervising these guys. I was able to build trust with victims. I had not been able to do that before, and in doing that, they call you when there's problems that you can head off. I was able to contact my guys when they were missing groups to keep them engaged in those domestic violence groups. And you're just so much able to respond to problems before there's major problems. I was able to get out in the community, check on them in their residence. finding lots of violations out there, lots of contact issues, and with domestic violence, it's very important that they engage in counseling to start learning those tools so that they don't reoffend. I kind of look at it as a train. You're watching a train. It starts to derail. You have the time to get that train back on the track. If you're just being reactive, then all you do is report to that supervising authority when a train wreck has happened. And then you find yourself as a probation officer saying, what if? What if I'd had the time to call that guy in for a UA when I got that community report? What if I had the time to contact the victim and ask her how things were going? It's really stressful for officers when they don't have that time. The point of this legislation is there. We feel there's got to be some emphasis on case-carrying POs. And I have not heard of any oversight from the DOC's budget or the governor's budget coming down to local control that puts that emphasis on case-carrying. In the spring of last year, we did a time study statewide. Obviously, the directors and sheriffs knew we were underfunded, no surprise. So a time study was done to see what exactly we needed to have a manageable caseload and how much time we were spending on high-risk, medium, and limited caseloads or low-risk cases. I included that time study in the handout, and it did show that caseloads should be between 50 and 60. As a result of that time study, it's my understanding the directors and sheriffs were successful at convincing the governor community corrections needed a bigger budget. And it's my understanding that bigger budget is being provided at the next biennium, or at least proposed. Will those directors and sheriffs spend that money on case-carrying POs? I don't know. None of us are confident that they will. And so we feel that this legislation could drive that to make that emphasis on case-carrying POs. In 17 years ago, I was researching last night, in 1990, we had 27 POs. We supervised in Washington County 2,700 offenders. Two of those 27 POs did non-case-carrying jobs. Today, 17 years later, we have 37 POs. Six of them do not hold caseloads. They're in other positions, and I'm not saying those other positions aren't important, but when they don't carry cases, then it falls on the rest of us. So, and our offender population right now in Washington County is 4,700 that we service. So that's an increase of 2,000 offenders and only an increase of six case-carrying POs in 17 years. We have never really had, besides that time study, research on what a manageable caseload is. I also included in those hands out a recent article put out by the American Probation Parole Association. We were really excited to see that article. They did a lot of research. If you have time later to read that, it talks about what works with offenders, what keeps them on track, what keeps them successful, and what keeps the community safe. And in there it talks about evidence-based practices, manageable caseloads, and they actually make a recommendation as to what a manageable caseload is. And it is in line with our time study that we did in the spring. last night I was meeting with an offender, and he said, you know, he's a great success case, and it took a lot of work, but a couple years later, he's almost done with his parole, and he's doing really well. And he said, you know, your name was brought up in our men's domestic violence group last night. And usually I brace myself because that means, oh, I'm going to hear what a horrible, mean PO I am. But he said, well, it was okay. He said it was Forrest that brought your name up. And Forrest is a guy that held a gun to his girlfriend's head when she was trying to break up with him and threatened to kill her and her friends that were in the house at the time. He did a lot of years in prison. He's got quite a criminal history. He's a huge guy, huge man with a loud voice, and for the past 6 months has kept me on my toes. He's been very busy and active. And I said, well, what did Forrest say about me? And he goes, Forrest said that he can't get one over on you, that he has given up and that he has come to his conclusion that he just better do his parole conditions. In the past year, having 50, that's what made the difference. I was able to stay on track, call him when he was missing, keep him engaged in his parole conditions. He's never been successful on a supervision, and so far I haven't had one incident where I've had to sanction him. So it makes all the difference of being proactive and active. And the money may not always be there to hire enough POs, but what we are asking is just that the emphasis be on case-carrying POs and not on pet projects the sheriff or director might have or projects that look good on paper but aren't really successful. And so I appreciate your time, and we're open to any questions.
Are there any questions for members of this panel?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cameron.
Yeah, I just want to thank you for your service to our public safety system, and your testimony today is very valuable. Thank you.
Very good. And you may second that. We appreciate your coming in and your patience waiting through the last session, the last bill, in order to get on for this hearing. We have Paul Snyder from the Associated Oregon Counties. Yes, and I had her on the list here as well, so why don't you both come forward.
Thank you, Chairman McPherson and members of the committee. My name is Linda Eaton. I am the Community Corrections Manager in Lane County. I'm also the Secretary of the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors, and I'm here on their behalf today. We are opposed to House Bill 2764. We support the description of the concern from the testimony that you heard earlier. We support the assumption that excessively high caseloads do not result in good supervision. We do not think that this particular bill is the way to address that problem. We believe that this issue may be better resolved by considering the governor's recommended budget for community corrections. It is the result, as you heard earlier, of an actual cost study that was done recently that shows what it takes to actually manage offenders in the community, which is not just provided by case-carrying parole and probation officers. It's also important, and it's our legal responsibility under Senate Bill 1145 for the county to provide a range of sanctions, supervision, and services for the adult felons that we supervise in the community. We can't do it with parole and probation officers alone. We need other services that are based on evidence-based practices to show what reduces recidivism. In Lane County at the moment, we would have 12 caseloads which would be out of compliance with this bill if it were law right now. We literally would have nothing to do with those cases. We could not supervise those cases if we had to comply with this law right now. I believe that this would put an arbitrary, inflexible stance onto the management of community corrections by having a state-imposed cap on caseloads. There are many flexible ways in which counties need to look at balancing their services. Some counties have more resources in other areas already than other counties do and can afford to spend more of their resources on POs and sanctions. Other counties don't have that luxury. Some counties like to keep domestic violence and sex offender caseloads a little bit lower than the others, because it is an extra workload. There's required contact with victims. There are special conditions, polygraphs, contacts with minors, all of those things that need to be monitored by those POs. So we need to have some flexibility in how to manage our resources. So to have in the statute a cap on the number of cases that a local agency could assign would be counterproductive and really, I don't think, would address the problem that was described earlier. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Eaton. Mr. Snyder, as you can see, we're down to a pretty thin portion of the committee. If you had any comments to offer to those of us who remain, we'd be happy to receive them. But
thank you, Mr. Chair. Just very briefly, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. I agree with the comments from Ms. Eaton. I agree with the premise of the proponents of the bill that there is a need for parole and probation officers to be able to effectively supervise the people that they have to supervise. One of the members of the last panel made the remark that the money may not be there to hire enough POs. That's true. And I think the best way to deal with that, as she suggested, is with the Corrections Department budget. The problem is, if there are not enough funds to hire enough POs, what happens to the offenders who are not being supervised because we have an arbitrary amount of caseload established for those POs? That's the difficulty when it comes to budgeting, and that's something that I think we just need to be able to do on a case-by-case, county-by-county basis, given the resources we have.
Okay. If there are no questions for either of these witnesses, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2764. I'm going to put the meeting into recess until I can determine what's going on elsewhere in the building that's affecting our schedule for the day. So I won't adjourn the meeting as yet, which means it could be reopened, and we'll try to give you some guidance as to what's going to happen. I would say, say if there's anyone here for the hearings on Senate Bills 189 and 260, and I think we do have we have a couple of witnesses signed up, Tina Kitchen, it looks like, and Nicole Brown on those bills. And are either of those people in the audience? And is there any difficulty in pushing those bills over until tomorrow? So Senate Bills 189 and 260 will be carried over to the next day's agenda, Friday, the 9th of March. We will go into recess to determine whether we can hold the public hearing on House Bill 2768. We are in recess.